to everyone in Metsville. My name is Rich Farrago, known on Twitter as MetsFanRich and CT MetsFan. You are listening to the 75th episode of the Metsian podcast with Sam, Rich, and Mike. And this is a very special one for a lot of reasons, but let's start here. It's very special to us as hosts of the Metsian podcast because it's sort of a relaunch of the show, kind of a rebranding. And ironically, on the night that we come on the air with our rebranded, our new logo and that kind of a thing, we actually are thrilled to have the mastermind behind that, a man who gave us quite a bit of his time to help redesign our logo, which enabled us to rebrand the show. A voice you've heard on this show before, I'd like to bring on the mastermind behind Mets Rewind and also all the great work for the rebranding of the Metsian podcast. I'd like to bring on John Struble. And John, first of all, you know, I will speak for Sam and Mike, whom I will bring on in just a second. But I do want to do this out of order tonight because we do owe you a huge debt of gratitude. And I'd like you to, if you could tell people, you know, about the stuff you do with Mets Rewind and some of the other stuff you're doing these days. And again, from the bottom of my heart and Sam and Mike's as well, and I'll bring them on in a moment to say it themselves. But thank you for all the work you did for us. So, ladies and gentlemen, John Struble of Mets Rewind. And John, please tell us about some of the work you're doing these days.
Well, first, Rich, thank you and thank Sam and Mike as well for allowing me the opportunity to serve you guys and to help you out as you go through the rebranding process. It was an honor to work with you all, great to work with, and I think you three deserve all the credit and all the heavy lifting for 75 episodes and really keeping Mets fans tuned in on the biggest issues of both the present and the past, too. So thank you, all three of you, so much for, one, having me on the show, two, for allowing me to work with you in that respect. So, yeah, Mets Rewind is a project I've been working on for a couple years, really just started with social media and Twitter, at Mets Rewind, and we just focus on Mets history. Our tagline is Making Baseball History Every Day, and you could also find us on the web at MetsRewind.com. I just wanted to throw in a plug, too, because we are going through our final weeks here of the Mets Rewind Hall of Fame, which is a virtual fan-driven Mets Hall of Fame online. We have 13 players and personnel and media members that have been inducted into the Hall of Fame by Mets fans over the past 2.5 years, and we are about to announce our class of 2021 here coming up very soon. So if you haven't voted in the Mets Rewind Hall of Fame, just go to MetsRewind.com, click on the Hall of Fame button at the top, and you can go ahead and select your selections for that. Beyond that, I'm working on a sports media blog personally just to try and engage younger sports media professionals, something I've done my total career, and I just want to give back to this generation, which is looking at a whole new way of doing sports media than it was when I grew up with. You know, we defined sports media at that time as newspaper, television, radio, or print television and radio. And now it's just a completely different platform. And I'm excited about that, getting to talk to a lot of the younger generation about how they feel sports media is impacting society today and in the way it's done. So that's an exciting time. So thank you for allowing me to share some of that.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for joining us. And at this point, I do want to bring on my, like we say, our co-conspirators, the gentlemen with whom I have the pleasure of doing this podcast on a pretty much on a weekly basis. So we'll start in Brooklyn because I always know where he is. He's in Brooklyn. And the other guy, I'm not sure he is all the time. So tonight what we'll do is we'll start in Brooklyn. Mr. Mike LeConlet. Mike, welcome. How are you doing tonight? And what would you like to say to John?
I'm doing well. I'm in the safety and security of my man cave. And I think John's being a little humble. I would like to do this for him. You can visit johnstruble.com. And that's where he is, in fact, reaching out to this generation and helping them get adjusted to this new climate and condition of sports media, as he says. So that's johnstruble.com. I thought I'd throw that out there. because I know he passed that.
Very good. And we'll go to the CEO of Podcasting Operations, the man without whom we would not have this podcast. It was his idea. It's coming up on, I think we passed 8 years ago. It was February. So we're past 8 years. Yes, we did it under a different moniker many years ago, but we've been together doing a podcast for 8 years. And that would be Mr. Sam Maxwell. So, Sam, I always like to ask you this. Not only how are you, but where are you tonight?
Tonight I am surrounded by the skyscrapers of Manhattan. They are all around me, which is – it's always as stressful as the city can be. There's just something different – and I say this as somebody who goes all over the tri-state now, the second that you come into the city from whatever direction you are, and I do mean specifically, let's not mince words here, Manhattan we're talking about, there is this all of a sudden different feeling that you get, whether or not it can stress you out. The city is wonderful. The city is magical. But Brooklyn is my favorite city in the world.
Well, there you go. And I believe, Mike, tell me if I'm wrong, but if Brooklyn were a city unto itself, wouldn't it be like it's in the top 10 biggest cities in the country if it were a city itself, right?
You know, I'd hate to say this as fact, but for a long time we've been going under the guise that it's the fourth largest city in America on its own. It might have dropped down to fifth or sixth at this point, but, you know, popular notion is that Brooklyn by itself would be the fourth largest city in America. What I will say with certainty, though, is one in every seven people in America can trace their families back through Brooklyn.
Well, there you go. My family would be one. Although I live in Connecticut, my family definitely has its roots there as well. So, all right, with that said, it's a full-service podcast. She's got a little history, a little lesson in civics and geography there, which we weren't planning on, but that's great. That's what we bring you at the Metsian podcast. But we also like to bring you Mets talk, and let's start on that. Gentlemen, there is a lot of Mets news to talk about, from on the field to off the field to all kinds of stuff. So let's start at the beginning. Let's talk with what is on the minds of most Mets fans, my own mind included, which would be the starting rotation. The Mets, you know, depth, you have to have depth and all this kind of thing. Well, okay, that certainly makes sense. But now you know why. Carlos Carrasco is down with a hamstring injury. It's a tear. He will be out 6 to 8 weeks. And from what I'm hearing, it's about that long until he can start throwing. So in listening to Ed Coleman this morning, it sounds like we won't see Carrasco on the mound until about late May, early June. And that's a blow. That's a blow to the Mets. So right now, what you're looking at, the positive news is DeGrom has been lights out in spring training. Taijuan Walker has been very good. Marcus Stroman has been outstanding. That's great. That's 60% of your rotation. The problem is the other two starters. So I'm going to throw out some names. I'm going to ask you guys to run with it. So here's where the Mets are. You've got Joey Lucchesi. You've got David Peterson. You've got Jordan Yamamoto. Peterson's been kind of Yamamoto's been pretty good, and Lucchesi hasn't had a lot of work, but he's been okay. So let's start with you, Mike. Rotation wise, please give us your thoughts on the fact that Carrasco is out and the Mets have to scrape a little bit, and how you see this playing out.
Well, they prepared for this moment, didn't they, with all their acquisitions in the offseason. Lucchesi, he seems to have the inside track to at least one of the spots in the rotation. I would also put Peterson in that conversation as well. You know, the Mets might very well start the season with two left-handers as opposed to one. Yamamoto, I think, you know, in spite of a good Grapefruit League performance, I think he's going to start the season at Syracuse. There's also a matter of options, who has how many. Peterson has the most. He's the freshest. Lucchesi, I think he may have the least amount. He may have just one, and Yamamoto might have two. But, you know, my gut feeling is Yamamoto starts at Syracuse. Peterson and Lucchesi make the rotation. And, you know, and we also can't forget, why is his name escaping me? Taiwan.
Oh, Taiwan Walker.
Taiwan Walker. There you go. He's also in the mix. So the Mets prepare for this moment. Let's see how, you know, it develops. I can only say that we should be coming out of this in relatively better fashion than we have in past seasons. He's a good live young arms. So let's see how it works out. Insofar as Carrasco, you know, he says it's nothing new for him. He's dealt with worse. And I agree with that, you know, but as a Met fan, you know, the last thing we wanted to hear is a hamstring issue. And, you know, you put that in quotes and forget the triviality of it all. But I wish him the best. I wish him well as a human to human. But, yeah, I hope he recovers and gets in the mix because he's going to play a very important part in this season. Will the Mets be able to overcome it? Yeah, perhaps in the short term. But over the length of an entire season, Rich, you know it takes a 40-man roster. So I just hope he does well. He has a lot on his plate, a lot on his mind. He's dealing with it well, you know, at least insofar as publicly. He has a clear, level-headed mind. You know, a hamstring is the least of his problem. Us as Met fans, you know, we let angst get the better of us. So I'm just crossing my fingers, hope for the best, and I'm in Peterson's corner. How's that?
I like it. So, Sam, I'm going to go to you next, and John, I'll go to you on this one. But Mike touched on something. I obviously, all of his comments are great, but I want to make a point about one thing you just said, Mike. The Mets might go two left-handers in their rotation, and if I were a betting man, I would agree. I would think it'll be Peterson and Lucchesi. Problem is, it's like a stock portfolio, you know, so that's great. You have two lefties in the rotation, but now one of those guys could have been in the bullpen. And now you're back to that other situation of having just Aaron Loop. Now, I know you have Tarpley and a couple of guys who, you know, might slot in there. But if you have to force one of those two guys or both into the rotation, you now don't have one of them for the bullpen. And if you heard Keith, I think it was Thursday or Friday, he said that it would be ill-advised to go north with one lefty in the bullpen. He thinks you need three. And so the Mets, you know, granted, you have depth and you plug some of that depth into the rotation. That's great, but you're shorting yourself in the bullpen. So, Sam, I'm going to go to you on that, and I'll ask you to reflect on the rotation. And one other thing Mike said that I want to point out is Mike made the point that they have young, live arms, and they do, guys like Lucchesi and guys like Peterson, and even Yamamoto's a young man, as opposed to last year when it was Waka and Porcello, you know, and I still have PTSD over that. So, Sam, I'm going to ask you to run with that one and what you think about the rotation and how they might shape it out.
Well, first of all, I think we got to start with Carrasco. You know, 34 years old. I don't think this is a same old Mets type of thing. You know, I'm going to be interested to see how they handle injuries. And considering that it was such a magnified thing at some point, the way Jeff Wilpon was basically it seemed the way the entire system was designed perpetuated the chronic issue that was these injuries. So it's going to be interesting to see now how the new ownership handles some of the rehabilitation elements of these injuries. But he's 34 years old. I mean, like, you know, the risk was there, and I'm not surprised that I believe the elder statesman of this rotation is having some issues. Now, I'm happy. I was having some internet issues, but I finally was able to look up Taiwan Walker's numbers for the last few years, because I had probably seen them at very quick passing. But you're talking about the youth, the live young arms in this rotation. Taiwan Walker is only 28 years old. This could be a very stealth, interesting move, and I was watching some clips of him performing the other day, and this is a big dude. And I know there was an article out there how he's looking at analytics to try to figure out how to be a better pitcher. And when you look at it, look at his numbers. Generally speaking, when he was able to get some length out in 2015 and 2016 with Seattle, but, you know, he was somewhere in the mid-fours, low to mid-fours, but then had a pretty excellent breakout year with 28 starts with a 3.49 earned run average in 2017. It looks like he's just had some injury issues here and there, but he was able to get 11 starts out of the 2020 season. And I believe my guess is he got traded for to Toronto for the playoff push and was really lights out in six starts here with a 1.37 ERA, 26 innings pitched. So this could be a very interesting move that is going to basically be the glue that holds together the front end of the rotation with the back end of the rotation. So it's going to be very interesting to see the way Walker performs in the regular season. And he's looked good so far. And, you know, some of these other names that are going to be at Syracuse, we really should familiarize ourselves with. And I'm hoping you guys just refresh my memory on some of these random last-minute Syracuse moves that they made for the starting rotation.
Well, they Syracuse, Keith even said that in the broadcast this week, that they will have a very stocked Syracuse team, you know, with guys with major league experience. And that's what you need. And Mike said it, you know, 40-man roster, you need everybody to compete, and they're finding that out right away. So, John, I want to go with you on this one. Taiwan Walker he's looked great. The thing about him that gives you pause, though, is he did have Tommy John, and I know everybody does these days, but he hasn't had a lot of work. You know, he missed all of 18, had I think it was one start in 19, like a cosmetic start the last day of the season, and then in 20 it was a shortened season. So, sure, most guys come back from Tommy John. You have reason to believe he'll be fine, but you know it's out there. And then Carrasco's out now. So, John, if you had a look at it, what are your thoughts on the rotation? How they might approach it?
Well, I'm going to be a glass half full guy. If you look at the rotation, Lee DeGrom is just he just still leaves me just in awe, even in spring training. But after that, I think Marcus Stroman has pitched really well this spring. I think they have a dual set of lefties there in Peterson and Lucchesi who could kind of fill the void temporarily while Carlos Carrasco comes around. And I think Taiwan Walker will just build up arm strength and he will just get better. Now, is that the perfect five-man rotation that's going to take you deep in October? No, but here's the optimistic outlook that I have. Let's not forget that early in this season in April, there is that potential of weather that may give us some length in the rotation. So a day that you wouldn't typically have off, you may get off because of a rainout or, God forbid, a snowout. But, you know, so the Mets might get a day or two here or there just to kind of lengthen the rotation and maybe have a four-man rotation in a couple weeks during April. You never know. The other optimistic outlook is if we can weather the storm, no pun intended, in April and May, in June, potentially Carrasco and Syndergaard return, and then you have a different-looking rotation in DeGrom, Stroman, Syndergaard, Carrasco, and, you know, however it plays out, Peterson, Lucchesi, or Walker, one of those three. I think you need to have a lefty in that rotation somewhere. So, you know, by June, if that comes together, great. If it doesn't, don't forget the trading deadline is in July, and the Mets, I think a lot of people forget that. You don't have to add all your depth and all your players by April 1. If you're right there in the mix come July, there's going to be teams that are going to be ready to move some players, and that's an opportunity to pick up maybe a last piece or an extra arm to add some depth. But I think at the end of the day, Rich, what the season is going to be dependent upon for me, that I'm looking at most closely, is depth, both pitching-wise, so that the Mets can pull from some of these guys from Syracuse. You know, they have a handful of names down there that could come in a pinch, too, if Peterson and Lucchesi or Walker just aren't getting it done They've got some guys down there, Corey Oswalt and different guys who may be able to come up in a pinch and give you a single game or five or six innings. But pitching and offensive depth, because you never know when one of these injuries are going to pop up on the offensive side and how will that impact the overall ability for the Mets to score runs. So at the end of the day, I'm optimistic. I'm not too worried about where they are right now. I anticipated, I was kind of waiting for the injury to come around. I didn't know who it would be, but I think you always get one of those in spring training. And unfortunately it's a little longer than I had hoped for or any Mets fan had hoped for. But, yeah, I think some key pieces are let's get through April. Maybe we'll get some extension there. June, hopefully let's, after those first couple months, if we're playing really well, you know, the Peterson-Lucchesi battle, if those two guys are in the rotation, let's see who performs and gets to stick around. I don't think there's anything wrong with good, healthy competition within the rotation. So I'm optimistic about it.
Yeah, that's a good spin on it. And yes, you make a good point, John, about if it starts out with both Lucchesi and Peterson, and I do believe that that's what it will be. But then in June, you have Syndergaard and Carrasco coming back. And, you know, the cliche, the tired old cliche, it's like making a trade. But on the other hand, it kind of is. Now, you wouldn't just be bringing in two mediocre arms. You're bringing in Noah Syndergaard and Carlos Carrasco, who are could be top of the rotation arms for a lot of teams, and they might just be joining in. So I think that that is a very good way to look at it, and it could be that in April and May, it's sort of like on-the-job training and an audition for both Lucchesi and Peterson. One of them goes to the bullpen when those two guys come back, and you know, maybe both go to the bullpen at some point, who knows, but that's not a bad thing either. You're talking depth, right? That's major league depth. And if they have to tap into some of that plate depth, they do. They do. And, you know, it's interesting, you also mentioned position player depth, and they have a lot of that too. You're seeing some of these guys like, you know, like I'll just bring in a Malik Smith by way of example. Now, here's a guy who, you know, has had some really good, he led the American League in stolen bases in 19. He's not as great defensively as he was, but he's still a very good defensive center fielder. He may, or any position out in the outfield, actually, he may have to start the season at AAA, but that's not a bad depth piece to go down and have to get if you should get an injury to an outfielder, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, I'm just looking at the non-roster invitees that are still hanging around. Jared Eichhoff could be a name that could pop in and give you a start or two in those early months. So could Tommy Hunter or Corey Oswalt. So they have a few names that have some good good major league experience under their belt already that might be able to help you out there. Mike Montgomery's another name. I don't know if he'll be a starter, but, you know, they've got a handful of names down there that could possibly come up and really help the Mets get through these first couple months.
Yeah, you're right. And Montgomery, I've heard they're stretching him out. And with the eye that, you know, either long reliever or starter if necessary. So they are hedging their bets by looking at a lot of options. Jared Eichhoff, you know, good call on that. They brought him in from the Phillies as a non-roster guy. I want to see confirmation he exists. I mean, I haven't seen him in any of the games since they've been on TV, and he's gotten very little work. So I wonder what the deal is. I mean, is he pitching a lot in the backfield? When I look at the box scores for games that aren't on TV, he doesn't get any work. I think he's thrown a few, only like a three or four innings all spring, if I'm not mistaken. So why that is, I don't know. But there you have a guy who has, you know, several years of major league starting experience. And again, he's not on the 40, but he could be a depth piece. So you throw him down there as a non-roster player. He probably would have to clear waivers to do that and accept the AAA assignment, being outright at the AAA. But if he'll be there. He could be there if necessary. So, all right, so we've talked about the on-the-field stuff, and certainly the rotation is number one on that. But now let's go off the field. Let's talk about contract extensions. So I don't know about you guys, but I'm getting nervous because, you know, the sand is dripping through the hourglass on these things. We have Michael Conforto and Francisco Lindor, both of whom say they will not negotiate and they will hit free agency if something isn't done before the end of spring training. They say they won't talk during the season. Well, you know, you don't have to be a mathematician to figure out that you have about, 10 days left, right? That's it. 11 days from or 10, 11 days from today, 10 days from tomorrow is opening day. And the Mets have got to work out two long-term or have the opportunity to work out two long-term deals for absolute mega dollars with two of their stars. So I don't know. Seriously, this keeps me up at night because I don't want to lose either one of these guys. And even though there's 10 days, you could say, oh, they can get it done in a day. You're talking over $300 million for Lindor. Goodness knows how much for Conforto. So it's not just the time piece. It's these mega contracts and having to do two of them. And we all know how Sandy Alderson feels about long-term high-value contracts. So, Sam, I'll start with you here. Am I crazy? Am I the only one concerned about this, or what are you thinking about?
Well, I mean, you got to certainly say that Francisco Lindor is turning up the heat to get something done right now. Conforto, they both had some pretty excellent offensive numbers today. So taking and you know off of a player like Scherzer. So I hear where you're coming from. Weirdly enough, I have more – oh, God, it's weird to say that I have more confidence in the newest player in Francisco Lindor signing an extension than I do in Michael Conforto signing an extension. Maybe
Why?
It's the Scott Boras part. Maybe it's the Scott Boras part. And I think that the Mets kind of recognize the need – for a shortstop that can change the game for them for the next, you know, because when you think about it, like Jose Reyes was supposed to handle the situation for 15 years. That didn't happen. It would be nice if they have somebody who can at least handle the next 7 to 10 years. And regardless of what you think about Michael Conforto, they're probably looking at the outfield situation as something that they can render they can fix easier than having just given up two shortstops in this deal. So factor that also into what their reasoning might be for prioritizing a deal with Francisco Lindor over Michael Conforto. And say what you want about Noah Syndergaard. I'm not exactly sure how that's going to go right now. But I think all those factors combined lead me thinking that we're going to hear some news about the Francisco Lindor extension. Michael Conforto, before the season starts, I'm not so sure.
Very fair. And I'm hearing those rumblings, too. And I guess it's because on Lindor that the Mets apparently threw him a number under $300 million, so even though it's not enough. Can you imagine that? Even though it's not enough, at least the Mets are in the stratosphere that he's talking about. That's maybe why people are saying if you get done for opening day, and the fact that they traded for him, and they will look like—I mean, come on—they'll look like fools if they don't sign this guy. Honestly, they gave up Jimenez, who's a hell of a prospect, and Rosario, who's struggling. I don't know if you saw it, but three errors in this game in center field. So John, I'll go to you second on this one. What are your thoughts on Lindor and Conforto and potential contract extensions?
Wait, I'm sorry. Well, did you say in center field, though? Sorry, John. Did you say in center field?
That's okay. Yeah, they tried Rosario in center field. The Indians did. And he had, I know of one game where he had three errors. I don't know if they played him. That was like middle of the week week.
In an alternate universe, I just hear you complaining about this right now, Rich, you know, where he's still in the Mets and they're trying this out, where they got a deal off with Justin Enes.
Okay.
Anyway,
I have to say this because now you triggered me. The name Ron Gant. Okay, when Ron Gant had former Brave, former Cardinal, when he was a Brave and he had to learn a new position, he volunteered to go to AA from the major leagues to AA to learn the position properly, so he could then, when he gets back to the major leagues, play the position competently. To me, that's the way you have guys change positions. Not like, hey, Ahmed, you've played shortstop, what are you, 23 years old, for what, 17 years? Just go play center field today. No. That is not the way you do things, and it will always bite you. And I feel bad for Rosario because I saw a couple of the highlights, and he just, you know, looked confused, and it's not his fault. The organization should be the adult in the room and say, look, we're going to send you to AAA. We want you to be a center fielder. Learn there. Don't do this to these guys in the on the major league level. It drives me nuts. Anyway, sorry. John, your turn. You can comment on that, or you can go with the contract extension talk.
Well, I just wanted to update you on that, Sam. If you want to see what Rosario looked like, you could either probably go to YouTube or Cleveland's website, but it was not pretty. They abandoned that deal fairly quickly. So on to the Lindor piece. I think he's the magnet for the future for the Mets. He's one of those guys that is going to be the priority to Conforto when it comes to contract negotiations over the next 10 days. He is the guy that will lead more people to the New York Mets if they can get him signed long term. $300 million. The Mets probably came in low there. I think that's a traditional negotiating tactic. Start low, you know, money talks, and then eventually get up there over 300. So I think the Mets will get the deal done before opening day because they want to. So I went ahead as we were introducing this subject, and I put it live on Twitter on Mets Rewind. Will the Mets sign Francisco Lindor by or before opening day? Vote and listen to the Mets, the Metsian podcast. And that was just about 3 minutes ago. And 83.3% say yes, 16.7% say no. So there's your early vote results right there so far. So I think the Mets will get it done, though. I do. I think they'll get it done before opening day. They don't want this hanging over their shoulder later in the season, especially if they're in a pennant race.
That's Lindor. Do you think Conforto not a priority?
I don't think he's the priority to Lindor. I think they have some more breathing room with Conforto, and I think even though Conforto said he doesn't want to negotiate in season, I still think money talks, and if you bring money to the table and he's performing the way he should consistently, that the Mets will find a way to get a deal done. That's just the way I see it.
I hear you, and I want to believe that, and I do to a degree. The Boris factor scares me, though, and that's the only flying ointment, as Sam mentioned it too, is I could see where Conforto's a lifelong Met, you know, and all right, he breaks his thing and he negotiates in season. The agent negotiates, of course, in season. Although today, if you saw him today, Michael Conforto said, I don't think about the contract stuff. He goes, it's happening now. That's between my agent, my family, and me and the Mets. And he said, and it's either happening or not. When the season starts, done. So he actually said it today. You can see that on Twitter. It was part of his the Zoom press conference after the game. So it gives me a little angst, but I'm hoping that the lifelong Met thing, that'll be a positive. I do fear the Boris factor, though. So, Mike, where are you with both of these gentlemen and potential long-term contracts?
Little riddled with anxiety, Rich. Insofar as Lindor, I think he's looking to surpass Fernando Tatis Jr.'s average annual value, which was low, I think, at $24 million. But because of the years involved, you know, the grand number just looms over all these negotiations. So, yeah, the Mets came in under $300 million. Let's just make up numbers. Let's just say they offered him $28 million for 10 years. That's $280 million. That's under $300. Does that sound reasonable? I don't know. I'm not a baseball agent. I'm not a front office executive for the Mets, and certainly not a player. So how much is going to be enough? I don't know. But, you know, this is negotiations and how they go. As John says, perhaps – you know, this is the Mets' first step, and they came in a little low. Perhaps Lindor's representatives answer back, and that number is, figuratively too high, and they meet somewhere in the middle. We don't know. But at the same time, if they don't get this done, next offseason, there's going to be several shortstops that are going to become available. Carlos Carrera, a couple others. And that's going to play into this if they don't get this done within, another 10 days before opening day, another 10 days in a wake-up? So, you know, I hope they intensify negotiations and get this done. You know, does $32 million a year sound reasonable for Lindor? The Mets might have to go that high just to satisfy a 10-year contract. Do you really want them going to 14 years now that San Diego set the bar? I don't think so. And, you know, we know that goes against Sandy Alderson's operating principles. So this is going to be interesting. If they don't get it done now, which I want them to get it done, meet his price. Do it. That's why you traded for him. He's one of the premier players in baseball. So get it done. As I say, Rich, he's a magnet. He's here. Other people want to come here. But if this goes into next offseason, the playing field changes because now there's several shortstops available. And now there's a bidding process amongst many teams, many players. And, you know, then what? I'm not going to get hung up on what we gave up for Lindor. You know, I think he's going to prove his value this year alone, much less moving forward. So I'm interested to see how this plays out. And I fear next year's free agency period more than I do negotiations not coming to fruition right now within these next 2 weeks. And so far as Conforto, I'm terrified. And it has everything to do with Scott Boras. Because he takes his clients to free agency. He makes them test the market. Scott Boras is a market maker. And when you sign on with him, you understand this as an athlete. And what terrifies me, Rich, is there's always one team out there that ruins it for everybody. You know, Colorado is notorious. We can go all the way back. Am I back on the show? Rich?
I hear you. Mike?
John? Is Rich there?
I hear you. Yeah, I'm here.
John, I hear you. Is Rich available? Because somehow...
He didn't like your Conforto talk. He, when Scott Boras came up, he bailed out.
All right, so I got to monitor this board until they come back. But in the meantime, yeah, he terrifies me because there's always a team out there, John, who ruins it for everybody. Colorado's notorious. We can go all the way back to Mike Hampton, you know, and their educational system in Colorado. They sign these players for mega deals, and they never hold on to them. They always rid themselves and wind up having to pay into, you know, having them leave in order to save money. Anaheim, but they're not so much in the business of signing and trading, but Toronto may be. Seattle, they did it. There's always one team out there that ruins it for everyone, and that's what I fear, that Scott Boras makes his client go to this team that's offering the world. And Michael Conforto follows through. He signs on the dotted line, and you'll see 3 years later, they're trading him because they can't afford it. That's what bothers me insofar as Conforto. Otherwise, I honestly don't know what he's worth. You always like to think you're paying for the future, for what they're going to do.
Hi, gentlemen. Rich is back, and Sam is as well. I have no idea what happened there, but Sam and I are both using cell phones, and I think maybe what happened is there was a cell issue, but we're back.
Might just be me and you. I guess it's just me and you.
All right. So let me knock him off.
Hey, wait. I heard Rich. Can you guys hear us now?
Yeah.
I got you, Sam. Rich is going to have to call back in. He just dropped off the board.
He just dropped off again. Jeez.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Mike, it's you and me hosting the 75th edition of the Mets Scene Podcast.
Well, I was just wrapping up. I was just wrapping up, you know, that Scott Boras terrifies me when he takes his clients to free agency. There's always one team out there that just ruins it for everybody. And that one team, they sign them for mega money, and they never retain them. They always wind up trading them because they can't afford it, and they always chip in a couple of dollars for the receiving team to help take them off their hands. Happens all the time, and that's what bothers me. So I have more angst about Conforto than I do Lindor. Lindor, that's just negotiation tactics on both sides. So I hope that.
And he's smiling so often that, like, how can you even think that he's not going to sign with us? But
I really think
we have Rich back again.
I really do think they're going to get it done. You know, just make sure you do. Rich, if you're back, I hand the show back to you.
Can you guys hear me?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, sir.
We're all back together there.
Don't know what happened. All right, so we have no idea what happened there. I think it was a cellular issue because Sam and I are using cell phones and we both dropped. But regardless, we're back. And it sounds like you were wrapping up on the Michael Conforto, Francisco Lindor potential extensions. And, Mike, I hear what you're saying. You know, there's always that one team out there who will throw all kinds of money at a player and it doesn't work out. You see it all the time where they end up trading that player. And you know, I'm a huge Michael Conforto fan. I think he could be actually and should be the captain of this team. I wrote an article for Mesmerized about that that ran this morning. And I know captains in baseball are very ceremonial, but Conforto is the guy. You know, he's been here, he's drafted by the Mets, he was in the World Series, consistent performer, steady leadership. You know, I don't want to go down that path too much, but I really hope they don't lose Michael Conforto, and I do fear the Boris factor. It's like that song, Don't Fear the Reaper, right? So, all right, gentlemen, let's go to another topic. This one might be a little more fun.
Don't fear the Boris.
There you go. This one might be a little more fun. And John, I want to start with you on this one. The Mets have a new member in their board of directors. Former governor of New Jersey, Chris Christie, has joined the Mets board of directors. And, you know, hey, George Bush owned a baseball team. He owned the Texas Rangers. So politics and in baseball, it's not uncommon. Christie is, you know, obviously still very active politically, although no longer the governor. And a lot of people on Twitter, and we have to talk about this because it caused a stir, Christie's a polarizing figure, you know, between the bridge stuff in New York and New Jersey and the whole thing. He's very opinionated and all of that. So, John, I want to ask your reaction when you first heard that Chris Christie is now a member of the Mets Board of Directors.
Well, I first heard of it. I should tell you the story. I heard it on Twitter, actually. Someone had posted it. And if you guys have seen the photo of him playing third base for the fire department, he had the fire department uniform on, and it was a fine form-fitting uniform, if you know what I mean. and the guy, I can't remember, I wish I could give him credit. He had posted the picture of Christie picking up a ball at third base and getting ready to fire to first, and he said, I'm going to tell my children this is David Wright. you're going to torture those kids. But honestly, as far as him being on the board of directors, I think that's social politics is what I call it. I think his impact on what the Mets do will be minimal. I'm sure there will be people who have taken issue with him and what he's done in the political arena and not be happy with that. But to me, I don't think he's going to have much impact on the Mets. Just like, Bill Maher owns a little piece too in terms of ownership, and he has no influence or say really in what the Mets do. So I think his voice on the board of directors will be heard, but he's also a political figure. So what's his agenda? And I just think he'll have a minimal effect, in my opinion.
And it's funny, you're talking about memes that have been around, and the one I saw that literally brought me to tears laughing was a picture of him over by the Shea Bridge, and he had closed the Shea Bridge. I think that's really funny because he closed the bridges.
was Bernie sitting in this meme as well, somewhere on the bridge or somewhere outside of the bridge?
It was just Christie in that beach outfit when he was on the Atlantic City beach. It was,
no, see, but I want somebody's got to do the combination of Christie on the beach and Bernie with the mask on in the cold. The combination of the two, besides the Cloche Bridge, maybe I need to get on it.
I could probably have a graphic whipped up for you guys before the show ends if you'd like one.
I bet it would be the hit of Twitter, John. I really do. So, Sam, since you're on, why don't you tell us your thoughts on the former governor of New Jersey being a member of the Mets board of directors?
Well, first of all, I guess the direction I need to start with is going that people need to just relax. And, like, this is coming from somebody who, you know, why don't we get into it? Why don't we go ahead and just get into it? I lean left. I find myself more in the middle than how obsessed I was watching MSNBC in 2008. Much more in the middle than that era of Sam. And I greatly want people to regard, like, listen, I don't want to say, like, every, like, you know, this is a very prideful thing that people hold close to their heart. I get that. But I don't think everything can be a travesty. I don't think that, of course, all of the, the problem with politics is the fact that, like, now we're grading on a curve. Well, they're not as bad as the other. And that is what I feel with when it comes to, like, getting riled up about who, you know, like, we should be – if this is a problem, Bill Maher elements should also be a problem considering how outspoken politically he is. And what's hysterical about Bill Maher is that he's one of the most left-leaning liberals you could find, and yet he's also outspoken against liberals with this whole cancel culture element. So everybody's always going to have an issue with what politics somebody else is involved in. With Chris Christie, specifically, Chris Christie was about to get the left until Bridgegate. He had the left in his pocket after Hurricane Sandy. And, you know, right before the election, he was standing with Barack Obama, and they asked him, like, you know, the Republicans have an issue with you holding fort here with Barack Obama, you know, from a political perspective. And he said, well, I don't give a damn. I want to help my state, which was the right move. But then his vindictiveness showed in Bridgegate, and he basically, if it weren't for Donald Trump, he who knows how that poll president, the election would have gone. But Chris Christie found himself probably getting moderate Democrats to completely a political pariah. And here we are now. What I know about Chris Christie from a Mets perspective is that he has no agenda. I don't see there being an agenda politically for being on this board. I know that he likes the Mets. He likes sports. We could say what we want about his condition from a physical perspective. But we'd be hypocrites if we're only talking about him, because look around this country. It just boggles my mind constantly how many people don't give two shits. Excuse me, my we're going there right now. As long as we're talking politics, I'm fucking cursing. But I think that he is a big Mets fan. He is a big sports fan. And that's the number one concern when it comes to thinking about this stuff from a baseball perspective. He wants to win. He wants to be a part of a new Mets era, and that's my only concern. I don't care about the politics, because that's just not what anybody should be concerned about. The only concern should be the Mets.
Fair enough. And, Mike, your thoughts. Does it bother you? Do you not care? What are your thoughts on Chris Christie being on the board of directors?
Actually, I'll pick up where Sam left off. You know, we forget about people behind their titles, you know, who they are in public and who they are privately. Always two different things. It doesn't matter what side of the table you come from. But like Sam said, he's a baseball fan. He's hosted shows on WFAN, you know, so he's interested in the fan. Why is he here? I don't know. What function will he perform here on the board of directors with the Mets? Mets, as John asks, I don't know. But I find it interesting to find out every once in a while, you know, who belongs to whose social circles. But Rich, honestly, I don't care. If he shuts down lanes headed towards Shea Bridge, I'll care. But this is a non-issue to me. To me, this is more corporate when you deal with the board of directors and things of that nature. Sure, there might be a political angle insofar as Mets relations with the community and the city at large. I don't know. I'm just assuming. But, again, we're dealing with a person who is a fan, a sports fan, and I believe a Mets fan. So, you know, a little bit of moderation, folks. That's all it takes. Moderation. I'll leave it at that, Rich.
That's fair. I mean, he's on the board of directors. He is a huge Mets fan, and he's also a big Rangers fan in hockey. And I think, you know, he's not joining the board as a Republican, or if he were a Democrat, as a Democrat. He's joining the board as a fan. And I just think some people have the idea that, you know, if you are someone who is a Democrat, then you say to yourself, how could they put this guy? This really offends me. But, you know, I think that's where we are as a society right now. But I agree with what all of you have said, that he's on the board because he must have some value to somebody, to Steve Cohen or somebody. And he's not going to be a Republican or a former governor who shut down the bridges on the Mets board. He's a guy who's a fan, and he's now on the Mets board. We just have to look at it that way. I think that's very fair. So you are listening to the Metsian podcast with Sam, Rich, and Mike. We have covered two of our four topics for tonight, and we're thrilled to have John Strubel of Mets Rewind with us. And so now we'll go into our third topic for the night, and that is Commissioner Rob Manfred. He is a tinkerer. He's constantly tinkering with the rules and proposing different things. And on the one hand, I give him credit because, you know, there's no institution in the world that can't be tinkered with. The question is, what are you trying to do? How are you trying to get there? And are these the right moves? So what Rob Manfred is trying to do is he's trying to do a couple of things. He's trying to speed up the game and put more action in the game, because we all know that in baseball, the ball is in play 7 minutes in a 3-hour game. Well, that's, you know, ground ball, fly ball, guys running bases, something like that. The rest of the time, the ball is not actively in play, and he wants more action during the game. So he's proposed some rule changes to do two things: increase action, speed up the game. And we know that the games are getting longer and longer, and I don't think we would be on this call talking about the Mets if it bothered us, because baseball's in our blood, but not everybody's like us. There are people who, you know, maybe they want to like baseball, maybe they don't. Maybe they like football, basketball. And baseball has to try a way to bring those people in. And right now, especially with younger people, baseball's losing that race. Yes, I know they're making money, but they're making money from people in my age bracket. And they need to find a way, because I'm not going to be able to pay them this money 20 years from now. They need to find a way to attract younger fans, and younger fans want action. And so that's what Rob Manfred is trying to do. And so let's talk about what I'd like to do here is roundtable each one of his proposals and get your reaction. You can be as long as you want, can be short, whatever you want to do. So the first one that Rob Manfred wants to put in place is the pitch clock. What I'll throw in here is we're used during Major League Baseball spring training games in 2019 and in double and triple A in 2015. Okay. So when they were used in double and triple A in 2015, they shortened the game by 12 minutes versus the 2014 season. That's an average of both. So that's fairly significant. So the idea of a pitch clock, when there's nobody on base, the pitcher has insert amount of time, 20 seconds, 25, 30, whatever it is. Pitch clock, Major League Baseball, good idea, bad idea? We'll start with you, John.
Pitch clock is a bad idea. I'm not in agreement with it, but I think you're messing with the game too much when you start to change some of these elements. I think baseball is a game of leisure, and I know they're trying to speed up the game to get a new generation of fans in, but I don't think a pitch clock is going to make a difference. I am completely against the pitch clock.
Let me ask you this before migrating away to Sam and Mike. Do you think it could have a detrimental effect on pitchers' health? Like they'll change their routine, try to work faster, and you might see some more arm injuries?
I don't foresee that. I have talked to pitching coaches. I have talked to I don't mean to be name dropping, but you know, Bob Apodaca and Sean Estes and some of these guys who pitch for the Mets. I've asked them about pitch clocks and their thoughts on it and what the potential is of those, and they don't see that, you know, speeding the game along any is going to have any impact on the arm at all. It just may impact the rhythm of the pitcher. You got to remember, there were guys on the Mets like Steve Traxel, who was very deliberate in the way he worked, to the point of, like, that was getting ridiculous. But, you know, middle of the road, I think most pitchers try and get up on the hill, especially if they're in a rhythm, and try and stick to that rhythm. So, no, I don't see that affecting the physical aspect to the game at all.
Okay. Mike, pitch clock, yes or no?
I'm against it. I'm against all these rules. They're too contrived for me. I'd rather let the game evolve. Now, that said, I've seen the pitch clock in independent league games. I go to Duck games. I used to go to Somerset Patriot games when they were still independent. So I've seen it in action. I've seen the electronic strike zone. I've seen some of these innovations that Major League Baseball is trying to, you know, implement. Some of them you won't even notice. The electronic strike zone, you don't notice because the umpire gets his call simultaneously and he's making the indication to the pitcher and everybody involved, strike or ball. But he's getting that information online. But the clock is just contrived for me. We all can go back to games and bring up people. Rich, John, we know. Stay on the mound and batter stay in the box. That's what it takes. Pitch the ball. Catcher receives the ball, throws it back to the pitcher, throws down the sign, next pitch. Routinely, games used to finish within sometimes an hour and 50 minutes, 2 hours, 2 hours, 10 minutes, 2 hours, 25 minutes. You know, I'm a little bit more cynical in this particular matter. All these measures to speed up the game, I think in our hearts we know they're not going to work. They're just going to give Major League Baseball more time for commercials. Games are still going to go 3 hours and 3.5 hours. I'm sorry, they are. But they're going to fit in more commercials. Maybe that's just cynical me talking. But pitch clock, you know, paying attention to the clock and the pitcher and the action on the field in the independent league games, they were getting off the pitches on time. It would take 2 seconds, you know? For the most part, it was happening. But that's just the natural flow of the game. And that's why I'd say it's overly contrived. We don't need this. Pitch clock. I'll leave it at that, Rich.
All right, Sam.
Specifically with the pitch clock, I mean, you just need pitchers like R.A. Dickey, who understand that you should probably get the ball to the plate within 15 seconds of receiving it or less. That's just how it should be. And I think that has more to do with the personnel, that has more to do with the coaching than it does with having any pitch clock. You know, it's a condition of where we are with the game. And I do, you know, unfortunately it might be inevitable, but it's just, I'd rather it not. I just rather the players get their stuff done.
All right then. So I think we're unanimously against the pitch clock. So let's move to the next one. This one actually, gentlemen, will be experimented with in AAA this year, and that is increasing the size of the bases. And you might ask yourself, well, why did you want to do that? Well, the bases right now are 15 inches across, and if you go to 18 inches across, the concept is it might increase stolen bases, right? Because what you have, so first base would be 3 inches closer to second base, and second base would be 1.5 inches closer to first base, because it would be 3 inches in first base's case. It would be all on one side, and then half and half at second base. and then third base would be 3 inches closer to second base. You could follow what I'm saying. So what he's saying is that it would increase stolen base attempts and the frequency of, and the success rate by having those couple of inches. It also might increase offense in the game because you might have more runners on base. You know, the close plays at second might go the runner's way a little more often because the base is closer. They're cut down the running area by 4.5 inches. So I get it. I get he wants more action and he wants more traffic on the bases and he wants more stuff like that. We'll start with you on this one, Sam. Is making the bases bigger the way to do that? What do you think? And bear in mind, it's being experimented in AAA this year.
I mean, when it comes to baseball numbers, I'm definitely going to be a purist. You know, how can you have anything less than 90 feet? Whatever that means from the center of the base, I'm going to have to research exactly what the 90 feet is, but that's what it is to me. 90 feet, 60 feet, 6 inches, 9 men, 9 positions. That's just how it works. So I don't, maybe that isn't innovative. Maybe that's not thinking ahead. But I just think that those little things, you have to figure out what you're doing wrong in capturing the imagination of society with the game you have and not figure necessarily out how you can completely obliterate what you have to make sure you're adapting. I think there's a better fine balance, and this is not – the bases is just not something I'm down with.
Mike.
It's actually funny. I'm okay with this one, Rich. Only because you're still dealing with right angles. So if you wedge them on to the field correctly, you're not changing the length of 90 feet. 90 feet is the perfect ratio. We know that. But you will be bleeding over into foul territory, first and third base. At first base, it's a good idea. At second base, it's a good idea. But at the same time, Rich, the need to do this just screams to me that skill level is at an all-time low. The artistry of the game is gone. The days of the pirouetting shortstop over an incoming guy looking to break up a double play and completing his throw to first base are gone. That's what I'm upset with. But getting back to geometry, you're still dealing with a square and a right angle. So it doesn't need to shorten the distance of 90 feet. You know, at second base, that's just going to protrude in its respective direction towards the outfield. You don't have to cheat those inches inward or use that center spot of center mass. You know, you can wedge the right angle to keep the distance. And because of the lack of skill level in today's players, you know, they need that extra space so they don't hurt each other. You know, and that's part of my problem as well. Rule changes, lack of skill level, the little details of the game, the nuances of the game, they're all gone. They're all gone. Like I say, that shortstop or second baseman having to leap over an incoming fielder or even a simple bunt, Rich. All those little fundamentals are gone, and baseball is only too willing to accommodate that. They cry and wail that the games are boring and there's no action. Well, you know, they have no one to blame but themselves. And I'm sorry, Rich, this isn't going to work towards, you know, getting that new audience as we speak into the fold, because name me another sport. Does the NBA put their championship games on at 11:30 and midnight? Does the NFL do that? Does the NHL do that? none of the other leagues have their championship games on 11, 11:30, and 12 o'clock at midnight. So they can do whatever the hell they want. To me, it's all a crock.
And that goes with what we're talking about, is that they're missing the point of why they're losing viewers. And so instead of tinkering with the game, figure out what we're talking about. Figure out, like, be on the same page with a sizable amount of people that recognize what you're doing wrong with why you've become the third most significant sport from a pop culture perspective. Figure it out. And this is not the way you do it.
Let me ask John and Rich specifically this next question. How many times in the 90s did you struggle for lack of sleep the next day at work after watching the playoffs in the 1990s?
Been on that one. The game, as I remember, the games were faster and they would start a bit earlier. So they would be over by 11, before 11, actually. So I'm going to say not as often, nearly as now, would be my answer. How about you, John?
The pace of the game has never been a distraction to me because I love the game of baseball. Let me just – I'll give you my 2 cents since I have the table right now. I looked at this a little bit, Rich and Mike and Sam, when we were prepping for the show and we were talking about some of these bulleted topic points. And this was a new one for me. I hadn't heard about widening the bases until I got an email from y'all this afternoon. And so I looked it up a little bit, and Rob Manfred cited himself that this decision was a reduction in injuries and collisions. That's the reason for the possible change. The idea being more room on the bases means more room for runners to reach base without running into or onto defenders. Okay, if that's your reasoning, that's fine. But show me the results. Show me the data that led to this. Because we've been playing this game for 125 years. I have not seen it be a problem until just recently. This game that I fell in love with is 60 feet, 6 inches away, pitcher to catcher. 90 feet between bases. There are umpires. There are 9 players on each team. There's bats. There's balls. There's 27 outs. There's 9 innings. There's bunts. There's sacrifice flies. There's stolen bases. There's runs, hits, and what? Errors, because the human element needs to be left in the game. This idea is not rooted in the spirit of enhancing the game in any way that I can see. I mean, you can call me old school. You can label me a traditionalist. You can label me any way you'd like. I fell in love with a game 50 years ago that will soon become a game that I no longer recognize. And that's my greatest fear of this whole debate about whether it's pace of play, whether it's widening the bases, any of this stuff. It's taking away a lot of the nuance of the game that I fell in love with, especially those smaller elements. When you talk about, how many teams bunt anymore? How many teams steal bases anymore? How many teams try to hit a sacrifice fly to get the runner from second to third or third to home? I mean, it just doesn't. Players are trying to hit the long ball. Players are trying to do things that are out of this world, which I think a lot of them would naturally do in their natural play because they're just such talented athletes. But this part of the game really concerns me. I hope I will leave this earth before the game changes too much. And it's one of those things that's like, I no longer recognize this game. I can't watch it anymore. That's what I fear most.
You know, Rich,
yeah.
And I'm going to continue a little bit here. If John McGraw and Chaim Bloom were choosing sides, Rich, I believe John McGraw would draft a team that would beat Pine Bloom. And what's that? Old school versus new school in analytics. I've thought about that long and hard. I do believe in my heart, insofar as the game of baseball and how it's played, a team drafted by John McGraw, the old manager of the New York Giants, Little Napoleon, and for all his technical and modern wizardry, Chaim Bloom and his analytics and implementation and application, Rich, I already said it. I think John McGraw wins. I believe that.
Well, no, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, that's it. I just believe that in my heart.
You know, there's a phrase we use in business called follow the money, right? The money will always be at the root, the root cause. And when we think about it, what do we pay for in baseball now? We don't pay for stolen bases. Like the guys like Malik, because he's on the Mets, I'll bring that up. Here's a guy who's trying to find a job, right? 2 years ago, he led the American League in stolen bases. The guy is literally a non-roster invitee trying to find a job. If you hit home runs, you're going to make money. It's like Ralph Kiner said, home run hitters drive Cadillacs, and singles hitters drive, Buicks or whatever he said it was. And that was the concept in the 50s. It's the concept now. It's what they're paying. And so if you're a young ball player, you know your payday comes not from going the other way, not from hitting a sacrifice fly, not from bunting, even if the manager tells you, you're going to get a payday if you can hit the ball at the ballpark. And if you strike out in the process of it, who cares? Same as any other out, which is the most
And what's interesting is you also have people like Michael Conforto and Pete Alonso who do strike out a lot, but one of their strengths is going the other way. And so and still the fan that follows this game loves to see that still. Now, I want to just real quick, and I'll leave it back to you, Rich, the problem that baseball doesn't necessarily pick up on from a foresight perspective is that they're going to butcher this game, basically leaving all the retirees that have plenty of money to spend who fell in love with this game a long time ago. They're going to leave all of those people in the dust for less people who now have been gained because of whatever random weird moves you are making to change the game of baseball. So like that's the weird balance that they are not necessarily doing a good job with, in that like are you really going to gain more young people following this game than the people that aren't even going to give you the time of day because they're too busy searching for the old clips on YouTube or searching the land for the old baseball elements because they don't want to watch the new game. That's something they have to think about.
Well, and that, again, go back to what's being paid for. You know, what's being paid for now is you can hit the ball at the ballpark. And then, and again, the thing that I was saying was this concept that strikeouts or any of their outs is the most absurd thing I've ever heard. How many times have you heard Tim McCarver when he used to do the Mets games and guys who have played this game and won championships? I think they have some credibility if they played the game and won championships. When Tim McCarver used to always say you win and lose games by the kinds of outs you make. There are productive outs, there are non-productive outs, and strikeouts are non-productive outs. And, you know, if you're man on second, no outs, and you strike out, you did nothing to help your team. But on the other hand, you're not really being incentivized by the compensation structure in the game to hit a ground ball to second base to get the guy over to third. It's just not rewarded anymore. And so guys don't do it. They're up there and they're going to swing from their asses, you know, with a man on second and no outs. But the art of manufacturing runs, I think it's because everything comes back to the money. If that's not what you're being paid to do and your big payday doesn't come because, you know, pat you on the head, Sam, you're a nice team guy. You hit that ground ball second base. That's not what's going to get you any money. What's going to get you money is to fall to the ballpark. And that's where we are.
And you know what's interesting, though, is that those little moments, though, where all of a sudden you need that runner to move over. Like you know, you guys know when you're watching the game, you can even sense it within that clubhouse and within that dugout that was a special moment, that those still exist in baseball and they might not be as dead as we think, other than the compensation structure.
Analytics Agreed. Say that striking out is better than grounding into a double play. And another pet peeve, Rich, I know you're going to like this one, but you no longer need a strong arm in right field because there's nobody on base.
Right. Good point. No, Roberto Clemente, tell him that, huh? God rest his soul. But you know, getting back to that, yeah, sure, striking out is better than double play, but striking out is a lot worse than advancing a runner, and you know what I mean? And long fly balls advance runners, even if it's not a sacrifice
Which
fly.
Is something striking you out. Can also advance a runner if you ground into a double play.
Right, right. But I'll give the analytics people the one about it's better than a double play in general. I will give them that one, but that is
Oh,
it.
I won't. I won't, but that's what they say.
All right, guys, I know we've had a lot of discussion on this, and I want to throw a free-for-all, spend 1 minute on this. I'm going to let you guys just jump in on this one. Widening the bases, I don't like it because, actually, I have a quote from Manfred right here where he says that the competition committee also expects a shorter distance between bases created by increased size have a modest impact on the success rate of stolen base attempts and the frequency with which a batter or runner reaches base on ground balls and bunt attempts. So they are trying to cut down the distance. It's not just, and John, you're right, it is about player safety. You have more bag in front of you, you know, to double play and not get taken out. But this is a quote from Rob Manfred himself, where one of the intentions is to cut down the distance to try and have more guys be called safe. So they are tinkering with 90 feet. That is one of his objectives. So let me ask you this. Free-for-all comment, going to give you guys 60 seconds to do it. I hate the concept of can you imagine what happens to Lou Brock's record, Ricky Henderson's records, if you're shortening the distance between bases? I can't stand it. But a friend of mine pointed out, would it make sense at first base only to widen first base by 3 inches all on the foul side? And he pointed to the J.C. Martin playing the 69 World Series because it is impossible, if you think about it, to run to first base in the runner's box and yet not be in the path of a throw from the catcher's position or somebody near that position. So what my friend was saying is widen the bag so they have a lane to get to the bag and they clear the throwing lane. It actually would make the game better. 60 seconds, wide open comment on that. Think about J.C. Martin.
Who's first?
Anybody. Whoever wants to talk.
You can wedge right angles in their appropriate distances. I like the extended bag at first base. It creates the lane, as you say. So I'm okay with that. The extra space, if it's needed at second base, again, you cheat those inches towards the outfield, not within the diamond itself. Again, you're wedging in a right angle. It can be done. But as you say, Rich, if he's actively trying to tinker with the distances, I can't support that. I don't like Manfred as it is, and I'm really biting my tongue from using bad words to describe it.
Right, but no, he. I hear you, Mike. You know, at second base, you can make it wider toward the outfield and toward the plate. And that might give the defender a little more room, maybe on a double play, but he clearly isn't, that might be one thing, but he clearly wants to shorten the distance. It is in writing, a quote. That's messing with a lot of stuff.
That's just plain wrong. That's just plain wrong and blasphemous. You know, Henry Chadwick, who must be rolling over in his grave right now.
I'm with you. I don't like shortening the distance at all. So Sam or John, on potentially, though, I am aligned with adding 3 inches to first base all on the foul side to create that lane and not have more J.C. Martin plays because he should have been called out. Yes, I'm happy to win the World Series, but he should have been called out. Gentlemen, thoughts?
I will say I've always thought it was strange that the lane didn't always seems like you're running in foul territory just to get back over to first. So I kind of get the idea of bleeding it over.
Agreed.
I don't see
I don't see any data or any examples of many plays that really would fall into this category, so which makes me question the whole, why are we doing this?
I'm with you, John. I'm with you.
I mean, I understand from an offensive standpoint, if you want to see more stolen bases and kind of pick up the action during an inning, that's fine. But base stealing in general has fallen to the wayside. Just go back and look at the league leaders in stolen bases over the last three or four decades. I mean, with the exception of guys like Vince Coleman and Ricky Henderson, Maury Wills, Lou Brock, those guys who stole the 100 bases, those are kind of like a separate level, a separate tier. But guys were stealing 60, 70 bases a year and leading the league pretty much, both American and National League. And now we're down to, like, you know, in 2019, the league leaders, Ronald Acuna Jr. stole 37 bases. What's he going to do, steal three more bases? Is that, yeah. I mean, why are we tinkering with this stuff? It's just, it doesn't make sense. It just, there's no reason for it. I don't see the need to do that.
Well, the modern athlete is a phenomenal specimen. But like I say, Rich, the artistry, each position has its own artistry, and the artistry is gone. Great athletes, no artistry, no craftsmanship.
Let me add one note on that, Michael, too. When you guys were talking about earlier about bunting and how it's a special moment when it does happen, I also sit there and get real squeamish, because how many times have you seen a guy come up to bunt in the seventh, eighth, or ninth inning to try and get a guy over, and he can't get the bunt down? I mean, these are major league athletes, and it's like he can't get the bunt down.
And it's incredible.
It's unbelievable. I mean, they spend so little time even practicing that anymore, or having someone who is exceptional at that. You know, I'm dating myself, but Bud Harrelson, he was brilliant at getting a bunt down. He was a 220 hitter for his career, but if you needed him to sacrifice someone from second to third or first to second, he was your guy. I mean, so he may have hit 220 and he wasn't, he's not the guy you'd want at the plate all the time, but he had other tools that could make him a better offensive weapon. And that's just one example of where elements of the game like that can make a player much more valuable.
Well, you know, batters were a lot more versatile as well. There was an art to hitting the other way to advance the runner. There was an art when you were in need of a fly ball to adjust your swing to accommodate a fly ball. And that's all gone.
Yep. It is.
And can I just say this, because I was looking through Twitter randomly, and I'm seeing that Jacob deGrom hit in a game today, speaking of strategy, because when a pitcher hits, there's typically a little bit more strategy. And he is quoted as saying, "I enjoyed it. I feel like it's a part of baseball. Kind of missed it a little bit last year." So we're all, you know, we've been talking about, Rich, you who have said, like, you know, you love baseball, but you kind of agree that the DH needs to come into the National League now. You have such a pitcher like Jacob deGrom that has dominated over the last few years, still wanting to hit. I'll go to you, Rich, to throw it around the room.
Well, let me just make one thing, though. I despise the DH role. It is the one in all of sports, it is the thing I hate the most. What I did say, though, is that I've had enough of the leagues having different rules. And if it had to, I would rather have the DH in the National League than continue with different rules for both leagues, because that is ridiculous. But no, I can't stand the DH. And I think it was a gimmick in 1973 because the American League wasn't drawing any fans, and it should have died in 1974, as far as I'm concerned. But I think we have to move on, guys. I think where we need to go next is on another potential rule change. And this one I think is going to spark some debate. And I know we're getting a little short on time here, so maybe we can try to consolidate the comments on the defensive shifts. Another thing that Manfred's doing this year, and this rule will be tested in AA, hear me out on this. It's not the shift as you think about it with three guys on one side of the field. What he's talking about is everybody – all the infielders have to have both feet on the dirt. So it's So you could have three guys on one side of the field, but they have to be on the dirt. You don't have a short fielder like in softball. And when I was writing the article, and I have an article about this on Mesmerized, when I was writing the article, I saw a quote from Jay Bruce, our old friend, who's now a Yankee, who said it's a little bit ridiculous when I get thrown out by a guy who's 270 feet, you know, in right field on what would have been a base hit. So it's an interesting one. Again, it's not stopping three guys from being on either side of the bag, although our own Francisco Lindor says he doesn't like that. But the rule being tested in double A, let's stick with that, is all infielders have to have both feet on the infield dirt to prevent the short fielder, the softball rule. John, why don't you kick us off on that one?
I disagree with it. Again, I think it's a nuance. And they're trying to force their hand into the strategy of the game, and I just think it's unnecessary. If a team wants to bring all their outfielders and all their infielders on the right side of the field and they want to put them all on the dirt or they want to put them all in the outfield, let them do it if that's what they think is going to help them do that. I don't see why you have to manipulate a team's strategy and what they want to do. Why does Major League Baseball feel that they need to get their hand in on a team strategy to try and make them competitive? I just don't understand it. I disagree with that.
All right, Mike, your thoughts.
Put me back on track, Rick. Rich, I'm sorry, because I was looking at the board.
Limiting defensive shifts, but not about
right.
three guys on right. It's about
right.
everybody
right.
has to have both feet on the dirt.
Right. The first thing that jumped to mind was that's how the position of shortstop was created over 100 years ago in the first place, over 120 years ago, over 130 years ago. That's how the position of shortstop was invented or created. You know what, Rich? In a strange sort of way, I like it. I like it. I'm tired of the shift, but I'm also tired of batters refusing to go the other way. If they're giving you a base hit on the left side of the diamond, by all means, please swing and take that base hit. So I'm kind of conflicted, but, you know, sometimes you got to fight fire with fire. I like keeping the infielders on the dirt. Just as long as they go about this on a transient basis. I don't want to see these rules for perpetuity. I hope this is just them tinkering around and trying to make some adjustments, and sooner than later things normalize. So that's where I stand.
Sam, talk to me about all four infielders have to have both feet on the dirt.
I think it's an interesting way to try to tinker with it. I mean, I'd be very interested to see what Leo DeRocher has to say about all of this. I know that's the way that life works, and that we could never get Leo DeRocher or two worlds overlapping that way. But it would John McGraw, for that matter, you know, to have a callback. You really wonder how, because at the same time, it is natural. It is a natural evolution of baseball to figure out that, hey, maybe we should put more people over here because he typically goes this way. And so it makes perfect sense that would occur, that this is what happened. But I'd be very interested to see the way Sparky Anderson or Earl Weaver or how did I just forget the one that was with the Mets? What was his? Oh, Whitey Herzog, who eventually went to the Cardinals. Gil Hodges. I would love to see the way they would handle the shift. That's really where I come in with this.
So let me say this. When I wrote the piece on Mesmerize, some people commented this. And I, if you all are listening, here's my response to that. Some people said they're tired of the argument, the go the other way argument. They say it's not that easy. Well, you know what I say to that? is it easy to sit up, to stand up there and try to hit a home run off a major league pitcher? Is that easy? I mean, are you kidding? If we're going to talk about, first of all, nothing any of us could ever do, I get that. But for a major league ball player, a really good one hits about 40 to 45 home runs a year, which is roughly, you know what? What is that? That comes out to 1.5 a week, right? So don't tell me that going the other way is not as easy as it sounds, but say it's completely fine to not try to beat the shift and try to hit a home run, which is the most ridiculous backwards argument I've ever heard. So with that said, we have a caller, and I believe I know who this is. So this is a guy, if I have it right, is a gentleman who goes by Big Red Ruckus, and he is very active on Twitter. He's a big fan of the show. And he's a fellow Connecticutite, although in a small state, he and I believe, live about as far apart as you can and still be in the same state. So, Big Red, how are you tonight?
Hi, gentlemen. How are you? It's a pleasure to be on. I just wanted to say hi and thank you for having an intelligent discussion.
Well, talk to us. What do you think about the rule changes? We've been talking about them for over 45 minutes. What do you think about these rule changes?
I think they're nuts. They're nuts. And I'm old enough to remember Gil Hodges playing four outfielders with the Mets. I remember Gil Hodges having four men in the outfield in 1969. Ted Williams played against the shift almost his entire career. You know, these things are part of baseball. The idea of all infielders needing to be in the dirt, what happens if somebody bunts? You know, if anything would bring the bunt back, it would be forcing all infielders to stay on the dirt, you know? All of these things, I don't mind. I really don't mind having first base elongated into foul territory. That's something that we do with the first graders that I work with. You know, if you work with the T-ball kids and stuff like that, they actually sell a double first base that you can put on so they run in foul territory. It's not the end of the world, but obviously it's a concession to people who don't know how to play baseball, which is something that Mike was talking about, right? The skills, these people are so physically developed it makes your head spin, but the skill set isn't what it used to be.
I'm with you. I'm completely with you on that. I mean, to me it's like, don't legislate the shift away, because you're right. Gil Hodges did it. It's not a 2010 on thing. I mean, the shift was around. Gil Hodges is an innovator. He tried it. You know what? Make your defense do whatever the heck you want with it within the rules. But it's a self-fulfilling prophecy because the offense doesn't try to beat it. And when you see it, like, and I almost wanted to comment this to one person, but I try not to when people comment on the post. Todd Frazier. Okay. I wouldn't say Todd Frazier is a particularly good hitter. He has power, but he doesn't hit for a particularly high average. What did he do a few times last year? Remember he pushed the bunt all the way through the right side, ended up in the outfield? Frazier could do it. He saw it, right? And he's not even a skillful hitter. He's not and like I ended that article with, baseball needs more Rod Carews and fewer Dave Kingmans, if you want my opinion. But please run with that, Red. It's great to hear from you.
They need more Tony Olivas, for goodness sake. Mm. But I'm old – again, I hate to say this, but I'm old enough to remember watching Dave Kingman bunt for base hits. Because everybody put him so far back that he would lay one down and he'd run it out. So, you know, the game has reached an interesting point where people are talking about things like launch angles and all these kind of things. And yes, I understand why Rob Manfred is upset that the ball is not in play. And it's obvious that strikeouts are way up and the home runs are way up, but everything else is way down. And that's because, you know, what started with guys like Mickey Mantle and Harmon Killebrew, even, you know, Boog Powell, those kind of guys, they would swing from, you know, they were not the same kind of hitters that Ted Williams and Joe DiMaggio were. It started back in the 50s. But right now it's at a point where it's, you know, the game is at an abyss, I think, because there it's I don't know, is it tennis now? It just you lob it one way, it comes back the other way. You know, it's just the game is so different now, and that's a shame.
I would also add that, you know, what Todd Frazier did and Red, as you say, what Dave Kingman did, those were singular efforts. They took it upon themselves. Managers no longer have that power to dictate the game plan. If he's looking out across the field and he says, oh, they're shifting me here, you know what? Everybody bunt. He doesn't have that power. That comes from the front office and the analytics department. And I actually think it's going to take, you know, sports is follow the leader. I believe in my heart it's going to take somebody to come along and throw that all out the window, do it the old-fashioned way, and actually win before we see, you know, all these drastic changes being reconsidered and revisited.
Might take that, but right now I don't see that. I agree with you, Mike. I don't see that day coming because the game just seems to be going more and more in that direction. I think you have a Rob Manfred who, look, I don't think anybody particularly likes Rob Manfred for different reasons. But here's a guy who I think what he's saying is this isn't working. You know what we're doing right now within the game and clearly the rule changes he's proposing to speed things up and get more offense, get the ball in play more. While the actual rule changes he's proposing don't really work, you got to tip your hat to him for at least understanding what the problem is. Now, he's not solving it the right way, but he understands the right problem, at least as far as I'm concerned. Do you guys disagree with that?
I disagree with his approach.
Agreed. No, I agree with that. Yeah, I don't like his approach. But I think it's a two-part thing. Have we identified the problem? If the problem you're trying to solve is fan interest and, you know, shortening game or whatever the components of it are, I think he's identified the right problem. Is his solution the right one? I would say no to that. But, guys, jump in.
Well, heck, let me go. I think you solve this by making the batter stay in the box. You don't let him go on walkabout. Same thing with – you don't need a clock, but, you know, you can certainly tell the pitcher to throw the ball. We all remember Steve Traxel. You know, he should have been speeded up. But, you know, these things about going around to the back of the mound and having a conversation with yourself and then coming back up and reaching for the rosin bag, that kind of stuff doesn't help the game. It's just to say nothing of the commercials. I mean, we're all dancing around it, but it's really about the commercials, and we're not allowed to say that. You know?
Can I also say though that this is something that we're talking about this, we're debating this. So many people else out there as well are debating this, but I think this is. There's something is more beautiful about the game of baseball than any other game in that we can have these such nuanced debates about what is going to ruin or make the sport. And Big Red, you mentioned Dave Kingman. He is a big part of the 1975 Mets that we will talk about at some point. And one of the things I love about baseball and that the 1975 Mets kind of remind me of is that there is no one way to have a perfect baseball player. Now, mind you, these numbers that I'm about to list about Dave Kingman are not perfect in any way, shape, or form, but there is value somewhere out there. And Dave Kingman in 1975 had a .231 batting average with 36 home runs. And 88 RBIs. That is very, very funny to see that type of line. But obviously he had some value, and there's a lot of different things to break down about the 1975 Mets. But that is one of the things that's so beautiful about this game of baseball, is that one way or another, there's some perfect balance to be found. And I agree with you, Rich. He does seem to understand that, but I need to see more to understand that he understands this isn't that it seems to me that they're trying to fix from certain angles of the game without picking up what truly is wrong and fixing those elements.
I'm with you. And I think, all right, so we've talked about Rob Manfred, and I've really enjoyed this discussion about the rule changes. I think I could say we're unanimous in the sense that we don't like any of the specific proposals. The one we like is not one that he has on the table, which is moving first base 3 inches into foul territory to create the lane. I think we'd all be okay with that. But, you know, I wonder if they do focus groups, large ones, and not to get away from small sample sizes and get fan input on this stuff, because it just seems like we get what you're trying to do, Rob, but no, just no. All right, guys, we have to move on to our last topic of the night. And Big Red, I'm going to invite you to stay with us because I know you have a lot of Mets history, and I'm sure you'll enjoy this discussion and contribute to it. So if you could stay with us, would that be okay?
Sure.
All right, great. So this is the 75th edition, and we're going to talk Team 75 Mets. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to throw out a couple of little factoids and ask you guys to run with anything you might want to share or your thoughts about the 75 Mets. And just so everybody knows, the order we'll take on this is we're going to start with Big Red, and then we'll go from there. We'll go to John, then to Sam, and then we'll wrap it up with Mike. So Big Red, you're going to be up first. Let me give you a couple of factoids about the 75 Mets. They finished 82-80, which is not bad. 74 coming off the pennant year was really bad. So 82-80 was a step in the right direction, but they did finish third. Yogi Berra was fired in August of that season. Just a quick tie-in. We had Skip Lockwood on the show 2 years ago, and Yogi was fired after a doubleheader against the Expos in August of that year. And that was Skip Lockwood's first game as a Met. That was his first day as a Met. He pitched in the doubleheader. And if you read Skip's book, he talks about how he played for Yogi Berra, the legendary Yogi Berra, for one day. And when he was on the mound, Yogi was in the dugout yelling, "Come on, Chip, come on, Chip." I just thought that's hysterical, you know, instead of Skip. Yogi had the name wrong. But anyway, Mets finished 82-80. It was hysterical, personally. Let me give you a couple of highlights. Okay, so on the offensive side, the aforementioned Dave Kingman, 36 home runs, pretty good, 88 runs batted in, .231. My favorite Met, Rusty Staub, had a very good year, .282 average, with 19 home runs and 105 RBIs. At the time, he was the first Met to drive in 100 runs in a season. So Rusty drove in 105 runs. Dell Unser, another one. He was only there a very short time, but I was a huge Dell Unser fan. He had a very good year. He hit .294 that year. So on the offensive side, they had Kingman, Unser, and Staub. I'll throw the name Mike Phillips, who didn't have a great year, but you all know he hit for the cycle, so Mike Phillips is on the team. Moving to the pitching side, our all-time favorite pitcher, I think everybody's all-time favorite Met pitcher, Tom Seaver, 22-9. So he had a stellar year. Kuzman was a bit off, 14-13. Matlack, 16-12. So I'm going to ask you guys to reflect on anything you want about the 75 Mets. I will say we are down to less than 15 minutes in the show, and we still have to do a last word. So I'd ask, if we keep the comments fairly tight, we'll start with Big Red.
Gee, remembering the mid-70s, that I would say it was amazing how quickly that 69 team aged. Tommy Agee was already out of baseball, and Cleon Jones was fast on his way out of baseball. There was a lot of conflict because after he got hurt, well, first of all, if you may remember in spring training, Cleon was caught with the young lady that was not his wife in a van, and all sorts of bad things happened. And by the time he came back, Dave Kingman had joined the team and was hitting the cover off the ball. And Crane Pool and I believe Milner still were playing first base, so there was no place for him. And there was a lot of turmoil about that. Moreover, it wasn't that Cleon was still the Cleon of 69, because he certainly wasn't. Rusty, of course, carried the team. Kuzma had a bad arm that year. But it's fascinating. What I remember about it, and I'll stop after this, is that Mrs. Payson and Casey died after the season, and Yogi got fired.
Very poignant things. John, 75 Mets.
75 Mets. My first memory is watching the Mets play a doubleheader in early August at Jerry Park in Montreal, and the two starting pitchers were Hank Webb and Randy Tate.
There
you go. Yogi Berra had kind of thought that these two guys had great arms and were potentially the going to get handed the baton from Kuzman and Seaver. And obviously, of course, history tells a different story than that. So that's my memory of 75 with the addition of Tom Seaver, as we mentioned earlier. That was his last, I think, great year with the Mets. 22-9, he was an all-star, won the Cy Young Award. And Kingman offensively was just, he was fun to watch. A guy who was hitting, I think he hit 36 home runs that year. And it was, the Mets didn't have that kind of power a lot early on. It was a lot of pitching. Clendenin hit the ball well, but, you know, even in 73, they didn't have real big power hitters. And he was kind of like hit those towering home runs. So 75 was kind of a mediocre year, but some fun players to watch.
There were, and Sam, I know you probably watched every game in 1975, right? But so then Jeff. but another, your friend and mine, Joe Torre, was a Met in 1975.
Yes,
I'm going to stop there. I can't say anymore. Sam, talk to me about 75. Like, what, as you look at the stats, what jumps out to you?
Well, it certainly is, you know, mostly just a stat glance, if you will. However, one of the things I will remember from a uniform history perspective is this. I believe this is one of the years that the Mets wore Mets on both sides of the ball, both the home and away. There was no New York across the chest. Tom Seaver, one of his Cy Young Awards, I mean, he completely dominated this year, looking at 22-9 with a 2.38 ERA. Nobody else in the starting rotation was quite as dominant. John Matlack was, you know, everybody else had a pretty solid year, but nobody was Tom Seaver's level. And I, just looking, it's interesting you were mentioning Skip Lockwood, because he did perform quite well in the short amount of time with a 1.49 ERA. And another thing, just looking at some of these offensive numbers here, I think, you mentioned Dell Unser. I was very curious about that. Jerry Grody batted 295. Ed Cranebull batted 323. Felix Milan batted 286. But Rusty Staub, what's so impressive about these numbers are the fact that he only hit, he hit less than 20 home runs, but was clearly a run manufacturer at 105 runs batted in. I mean, that is where it really sticks out to me. How you're talking about he carried this team, it's just impressive. And you can see, I mean, besides all of the other years that he had and the fact that, like, he was with the Mets on and off through the 80s, basically, you can see with that why so many fans, Rusty is one of their favorites. And, you know, what can you say about Dave Kingman? One of the highlights of that 1975 Mets yearbook on SNY is Dave Kingman looking like he's actually personable, but, you know, we all know otherwise here and there. That's what I think when I see these 1975 Mets and, you know, just Yogi Berra got fired with a 56-53 record.
Yeah. And if anybody's interested, Oral Roberts just beat Florida. I mean, my God, they just beat Ohio State, now they just beat Florida. So, Mike, please comment on the 75 Mets. And correct me if I'm wrong, but that was the year of Mike Vail's hitting streak, right? He only played in 38 games, but he had the hitting streak. So, Mike, run with 75.
Yes, it was, Rich. And, you know, Rusty Staub is my hero. He's a titan to me. And, yeah, this guy Mike Vail comes around. He hits 302 in 162 at-bats. And guess what? The Mets don't re-sign Rusty Staub. So there's always that at the end of the season. But, you know, Rusty Staub is a titan to me. And I'm still a little kid. I'm having a lot of fun in appreciation of a lot of these guys, Grody, Harrelson, Cranepool, Seaver, Kruseman. I know they won that championship. And, you know, I had my get a memories from 73 championship, National League championship, you know. So I'm still going to games in appreciation of those guys, knowing that I'm looking at champions. You know, because the Yankees still aren't a threat to me as a Met fan. And I'm spending a lot of time at Shea Stadium because of the Mets and the Yankees are both playing at Shea Stadium while the renovation of Yankee Stadium is going on. And my father was a big Tom Seaver fan, so he always wanted to be there for those games as well. So I got to see Tom Seaver's season up close that season, that year. And what a sight that was to see. It was pretty incredible stuff. I was also pissed off, Rich. Tug McGraw was no longer a Met. I never got over that. I'm still not over it. But at the same time, in 1975, I got John Milner's autograph. And that might have been the highlight of my season.
There you go. I'm not happy about the fact Tug wasn't a Met. I mean, my God, I love Tug McGraw. So, guys, we are down to it's almost it here. We're down to just a few minutes left. And so what I'd like to do is once again, thank Mr. John Strubel, who has been our guest for tonight, of Mets Rewind, for all that he has done for us and helping us rebrand the show. So John, can you just remind folks where they could find you and your work if you could, please?
Sure. At Mets Rewind on Twitter and all social media platforms, including Instagram and Facebook. Website MetsRewind.com. And I'll just give you this final note real quickly. We did that poll. Will the Mets sign Francisco Lindor before opening day, by or before? 219 votes, 80.4% say yes, 19.6% say no.
Awesome. Thank you for doing that and sharing the results. That is a great feature to add. So, guys, we're at the point of the show where we do our last word, and it's perfect because we're coming down to the very end. I know, Red, you haven't done this with us yet, but really the last word is just something that's on your mind. So what we've talked about so far tonight, we talked about Chris Christie. We talked about Carlos Carrasco. What do those guys have in common, right? We talked about Carlos Carrasco and his injury. We talked about the rotation. Talked about Conforto and Lindor potentially signing extensions. Like I said, I talked about Chris Christie. We talked about potential rule changes, and we talked about the 75 Mets. So your last word could be something about any of those topics, could be something completely different. So, Red, I'm going to invite you to just what you like your last word. It could be a couple of words, or what's your last thought for tonight?
Gee. Well, I said something along these lines before, but just imagine if Tommy Agee and Cleon Jones had taken better care of themselves.
Mm.
Just think about that. And I'll leave it at that.
Very fair. I like that. John, if you'd like to give us your last word for tonight, what would that be?
Sure. Just a foreshadowing. Chris Christie will be in the Mets rotation by June.
There you go. I like it. That's great. All right. So, Mike, we have covered the gambit tonight. We even talked about Brooklyn being the fourth largest city if it were a city on its own. So we've covered everything tonight. What's your last word?
Let's go Mets. They had a good off season. We're well prepared. I'm excited for the season to start. 10 more days in a wake up and let the games begin.
Fantastic. All right. So the only way to wrap this up is to go to the CEO of podcasting operations, Mr. Sam Maxwell, the grand poopah. I think about the Flintstones when I say that. So Sam, what is your last word? How would you like to end the 75th episode of the Metsian podcast with Sam, Rich, and Mike, and actually the first episode under our new logo and our rebranding? How would you like to wrap it up?
You know, it's such an anticlimactic thing to mention Francisco Rodriguez, the only number 75 in Mets history, but I'm going to throw it out there. While we try to wrap up an extension with another Francisco, got to give a shout-out to Francisco K-Rod Rodriguez for a up-and-down, ebb-and-flow career as number 75 with the New York Mets. I think it's the only breath that he should have on this podcast, number 75, so I will give him that. And I will also say that even in spring training, it's always nice to see that the Mets beat the Nationals, and hopefully we can continue to see that throughout the summer. So that's the only way that I can end the Metsian podcast. And, without further ado, let me send it back to you, Rich, to wrap us up.
Yeah, I'm going to wrap it up, and we have about 2 minutes left, just about three. Thinking about history, I want to throw this in just as we wrap it up. You know, there's this animosity between Mets fans and Yankee fans. I think it's kind of fun. You know, it exists. Let's face it, it exists. I saw something today that I never knew. 1961 is a few years where I was born. And what I saw happen today in 1961 is that the Yankees officially told the Mets that the Mets would not be able to share Yankee Stadium with them when the Mets began play in 1962. And the Mets were forced to find an alternate place to play and had to go to the Polo Grounds. Now, why I think that's interesting is I never knew it was up to the Yankees to do that, because I thought both stadiums, or stadia, whatever the proper grammar is, were owned by the city. I didn't think the Yankees had that kind of authority, but there's animosity going back to even before when the Mets even played a game, because the Mets wanted to play at Yankee Stadium. And I guess it was a retribution for the Mets hiring George Weiss, from what I've read. But I thought that was fascinating. In the last minute, does anybody want to add anything to that?
I don't think the city took control of Yankee Stadium until the renovation of 74-75.
That is correct. That is correct.
There you go. So the Yankees had the right to tell the Mets to, you know, thanks but no thanks. So therefore, as Mets fans, when we say we don't like the Yankees, it goes back to even before the Mets ever played a game. I never knew that. I thought I would share it. And with that said, guys, it has been fun. It has been a blast. John, thank you for all you've done. Thank you for joining us tonight, Big Red. Please call again. We love having you. Sam and Mike, my partners, great show tonight, gentlemen. And Sam, you are the only person qualified to say the last thing we say on the air, and what is that?
I can't wait for baseball. I'm so happy spring is here. And the only way to finish this, the Metsian podcast, is Let's Go Mets. Let's go Mets. Let's go Mets. Let's go Mets.
Yeah.
Take care, everybody.
Good night, everybody.